In 1970, the President of the United States called drug abuse education a national priority. As a preventive measure, he said, drug education must reach all publicly educated children from kindergarten through the 12th grade. Well, that same year, Congress lowered the voting age from 21 to 18, and a movement began to extend other rights and privileges of adulthood. Between 1970 and 1975, 29 states reduced their minimum drinking age. 3 years later, the National Commission on Marijuana and Drug Abuse declared, "The avalanche of drug education in recent years has been counterproductive." The commission recommended a moratorium on drug education until existing programs were evaluated. Despite the call for moratorium, though, education programs continued in America's schools, but by 1987, there was sufficient concern and pressure on Congress to raise the drinking age uniformly to 21. Well, in 1989, another president declared another war on drugs. What effect have drug and alcohol education programs had on America's young people? And has raising the drinking age reduced drinking among minors? I'm Susan McInnes for KUAC-FM, and these two questions are the focus for our next hour together. My guest is David J. Hansen, professor and chair of the Department of Sociology at the State University of New York at Potsdam. For the past several years, Professor Hansen and his colleagues have been engaged in the study of drinking patterns and of drink-related problems among college students. They've looked at the effect of drug education and of laws regarding the drinking age. What they've found might be surprising and somewhat disturbing to those concerned about substance abuse among America's youth. Dr. Hansen, welcome.
Thank you. It's good to be with you.
I should tell people who are listening that we'll be talking to you by phone, so if it sounds a little like a satellite transmission, it is. Dr. Hansen, this nation has been concerned and lately nearly riveted by its concern about drug and alcohol use among youth. I've sketched some of our reactions at the national level, but can you look more closely at our concern? How long have we been worried about kids, drugs, and alcohol?
Well, the concern about drugs as such, the non-alcoholic drugs in particular, really began in the mid-1960s. And I think the impetus there was the realization that drug use was becoming rather prevalent among middle-status, middle-income youth. Before that time, it had been relegated to pockets of the population and did not really draw much attention of ours until then.
So essentially, when it began to affect the neighborhoods of the white middle class, the nation became more and more concerned.
That's right. Now, of course, we've had a concern in our society with alcohol much earlier than that. And, of course, we had a concern in the United States with alcohol use among adults that led to prohibition around 1920. So the concern about alcohol is much longer and more enduring than the concern with non-alcohol drugs.
Can we let us then separate a bit and lead this first part of this discussion on alcohol and youth? That's been a lot of your study for the past several years, has it not?
That's right. Dr. Ruth Ings of Indiana University and I have been collaborating on research dealing with alcohol use and abuse among collegians since the early 1980s.
Can you take a look at that for us? What is the extent of alcohol use over time among college-age students?
Well, if we look back to the 1930s, Dr. Ings and I analyzed the published research on the subject of collegiate alcohol use beginning in the mid-1930s, and we found that through the 30s and the 40s, the 50s, the 60s, and most of the 70s, there was a very gradual increase in the proportion of college students who consume alcohol. However, by the mid to late 1970s, there was a peaking of use, and since that time, there's actually been a very slow but gradual and rather consistent decline in the proportion of college students who use alcohol. And of course, this, I think, is somewhat contrary to a popular stereotype, which would hold that there's a burgeoning increase in alcohol consumption among college students and other youth.
Which is reflected in the drug education programs developed by President Nixon and also in our raising of the drinking age in this decade.
Yes, well, I think the raising of the drinking age this decade reflected the concern about auto accidents. And there is some evidence that raising the drinking age may have led to some decrease in the auto fatality rate among young people. The evidence is somewhat unclear and somewhat inconsistent, but more people than not tend now to be arguing that it has had a positive effect upon auto fatalities.
Can you go back and attribute the decline, the what you call the gradual decline in drinking in the late 70s and early 80s, to anything in our society? Is it explainable?
I don't think anybody knows for sure why. I suspect that it may be tied into an increased concern with health in general. We know that there's been a decline in the proportion of adults who smoke, for example. And our latest concern seems to be cholesterol. Back then, people were jogging. That was the beginning, it seems to me, of the really widespread concern with jogging and some other health concerns. So I suspect that it's very largely health concern that has led to this decline.
Which may have started in the early 60s with John F. Kennedy's fitness programs in the schools. Is that a possibility? I'm looking for where things emerge from, how they...
Well, I remember that about the mid-70s, there was a considerable increase in jogging and concern with health.
Uh-huh.
Now, where it came from, I really don't know, but it does appear to have occurred. And, of course, that is, again, as I said, tied in, it seems to me, also with the decline in smoking.
We're talking by phone today with David J. Hansen, who is professor of sociology at the State University of New York at Potsdam, and for the past several years has been with his collaborators studying drinking patterns among college-age students. My next thought is to look at the difference between what you call, what you see as a decline in drinking and the heightened concern we have over drinking. Is there a separation between our beliefs and attitudes and the reality, or are there various realities happening in this country?
Well, there may be various realities that are not totally consistent with one another, but you raise a very interesting point, which is that, in fact, our perceptions of behavior are not necessarily associated with the reality of the behavior. If we look at another context, we know that the perception of crime is not necessarily closely associated at all with the actual incidence of crime. Sometimes people think that crime is on the increase when it's on the decrease and vice versa. I think there are probably several reasons why there's an increased concern over drinking among young people. I alluded to the concern over auto fatalities. But if we look at the college campuses, we can see that administrators, for the most part around the country, are faced with very tight budgets. And unfortunately, a fair amount of vandalism goes on most campuses, and most of that is alcohol-related. Now, while the dollar amount in terms of absolute budget may not be very significant, I think there is the perception that alcohol-related vandalism is incurring unnecessary costs to institutions that can really not afford to lose money unnecessarily.
Alcohol-related vandalism is also something that seems to offend us in society, especially the vandalism of schools, other institutions, churches.
Yes, and so the reaction, it seems to me, is tends to be out of proportion to the actual damage done.
And so, similarly, our reaction may be heightened by the problem of drinking and driving, because a car accident that takes a young person's life feels so wasteful to us. Is that logical?
Yes, of course. When it happens in our own families or people close to us, of course, the death at any age is painful. But we have it; we can more readily accept the death of a person who is, say, in retirement age or fairly old, because we know that everyone has to die eventually. But the death of a young person or even a child is not consistent with our expectations as to how life should be, and we tend to see it as a tragic waste, which I think you can argue it really is.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think we're much more concerned about the carnage and the death of young people than we are of the death of older people on the highway.
Did this distress of ours lead to the very notable success of such groups as Mothers Against Drunk Driving or Students Against Drunk Driving? MAD, SAD, DAD, that whole run of acronyms?
Well, I think it may very well be that those groups heightened public awareness. I'm not sure what the causal sequence is, but I think they have been very important in raising our awareness of problems dealing with alcohol and driving. Of course, unfortunately, we tend to focus simply upon alcohol and driving, when in fact alcohol leads to many deaths and many injuries that are not related to driving.
Such as?
For example, on the work in the work site, in boating, in swimming, in sports, even, surprisingly, in sleeping. I came across an interesting and tragic case in which a young woman on her 21st birthday was taken out by her friends, and she drank too much, and they took her back to her dorm and put her to bed, and during the night she choked to death on her own vomit. Now, that's not a pretty sight, thing to think about, but I mention it to point out the fact that it's never safe to be drunk.
Mm-hmm.
And unfortunately, we've tended to focus only on the drinking and driving rather than on the fact that intoxication is never a safe condition.
Let's use that statement to turn to your studies. You have been studying drinking behavior since the late 70s. Am I accurate there?
Well, individually, I began about 1970, and my collaborator began shortly thereafter. And we worked independently until the early 80s, and we realized that we were interested in the same phenomena and we were using the same kinds of techniques, and we decided to join forces and collaborate. So we've been collaborating since the early 80s.
And what are some of the things you've learned from your studies? What are the results?
Well, one of the things I've been interested in has been gender differences in drinking. And in our current studies, we use some of the very questions that were used way back in the late 40s. And so we've been able to trace responses of college students to the very same questions over time. And one of the things that we are able to document is that if we go back to essentially 1950, to a very classic study by Strauss and Bacon of college student drinking, at that time there was about a 20 percentage point difference in consumption. That is to say, let's say 80% of the males were drinking, 60% of the females. I don't remember the exact figures off the top of my head, but there was a 20 percentage point difference. And I've been able to document that this discrepancy or difference in the proportion of males and females who drink has rather steadily declined over time. And in one recent study, I found that there was no difference. However, I think that was just a little bit of a fluke. I think that essentially males are a little bit more likely to drink, and they're still more likely to drink to excess than are females. But a very clear pattern then is that there has been a decline in what we might call the double standard in drinking between males and females. And that really seems a reflection or a part of the general trend over the last few decades in the reduction of double standards of behavior, be it political or sexual or smoking and other kinds of behaviors.
And are women beginning to show the same sorts of alcohol-related problems and the same extent of them as young males?
Well, the literature reports an increase in alcoholism among females. But I, quite frankly, don't know how to interpret that. It may very well be that we're simply getting better reporting of something that's always been there.
Hmm.
And as time progresses, the the proportion of females who are reported to have either drinking problems or alcoholism just continues to increase. Now, whether it'll ever reach that of males, I simply don't know. But I think a big part of that is the recognition of something that has been going on for a very, very long time.
Your studies included studies of students at the University of Alaska Fairbanks. Is that so?
And
are we in Fairbanks consistent with drinking patterns among college students in other parts of the nation?
I have not broken the data out by specific individual schools, but it wouldn't surprise me if you found that the students and others on campus there believed that they had a higher rate of drinking or more drinking problems. One of the things I've discovered around the country is that practically every school seems to believe that it is unique in having an unusually high rate of drinking or rate of drinking problems. And logic would tell us that not every school could have an unusually high level or rate. It would be the Lake Wobegon phenomenon, perhaps in reverse. So we do know that that there are demographic characteristics that are associated with increased rates of drinking problems. Males are more likely to have drinking problems than are females. Blacks are much less likely either to drink or to have drinking problems than are whites. Business majors are much more likely to have drinking problems and to drink excessively and heavily than are those, say, in education or the health profession. Institutions in small towns tend to have higher proportions of drinkers and heavy drinkers. And there it would appear that that these would be residential institutions and that they would also have fewer opportunities for cultural or sports activities than would institutions in larger cities.
And part of sports and cultural activities in many places is alcohol. It's the drinking of spirits.
Yes. And of course, colleges themselves, it seems to me, constitute an artificial environment. Of course, what we've done in our society has been to create a period of adolescence that many societies don't even recognize. In many societies, we have people who are children, and then they are children until they're adults, and we don't have this sort of time-out period that we call in our society adolescence. So students at college are still in this adolescent time-out period, and I think there's a lot of evidence that college campuses typically have a drinking subculture that encourages excessive drinking, heavy drinking, widespread drinking. One of the good things to realize, satisfying and gratifying things to realize, is that students' drinking behavior in college is not very predictive of their drinking behavior when they leave college.
Is that partly having to do with what you call this adolescent timeout period?
Yes. I think it's related to a lot of things. We tend to associate drinking with adulthood, yet we tell young people that they cannot drink. And so when they leave home and go to college or enter the military or basically get away, particularly in a sort of closed environment like the military or college, they're likely to experiment and also to want to drink to show that they are, in fact, adults. And that's a kind of artificial environment. And when they leave college, they tend to resume what you might call normal drinking patterns. And interestingly, excessive drinking for many decades has been demonstrated among freshmen. And then as students progress from freshman, sophomore through the through the senior year, excessive drinking tends to decline. So it's that freshman year where the most excessive drinking occurs, where the experimentation occurs, you almost get the sense that students are away from home and the strictures of the home life, and they say, ah, we're here, now we can do what we want to do, and they'll stay up until 3 and 4 o'clock in the morning, typically, and by the time they're seniors, they decided that it really makes better sense to get to bed earlier and to drink less also.
And in some ways, this shows a progress from adolescence through adulthood by the age of 21 or 22, or at least in some adult attitudes.
Yes.
You know, at the onset of this discussion, I opened by saying that in 1970, the voting age was lowered, and that along with that came pressures to give other adult rights to young people. In 1987, that one of the adult rights that had been given by many states anyway, which is the right to drink as of the age of 18 or 19, variously in states, that right was taken away, and students who had been drinking, young people who had been drinking, were told they could do it no more. Those who were coming on to the ages of 18 or 19 were told they had to wait by law until the age of 21. What effect did this have in your studies? How did this, was this reflected in your studies?
Well, as we had said earlier, Dr. Ings and I had been looking at the incidence of collegiate drinking and had documented, as had many others, the fact that the proportion of drinkers increases as students age and as they progress through their college careers. In other words, as they go through their college careers, more of them drink. Now, 2 years ago, as you indicated, the federal government basically mandated that states raise their drinking and their purchase laws. And we conducted another of our nationwide studies beginning 2 months after the imposition of that legislation. And we had believed that the legislation would be, at the very least, ineffective. But beyond that, we believed, because of a theory that I'll mention called reactance theory, that the legislation might very well prove to be counterproductive. Now, reactance theory, in essence, holds that we all want to be free and autonomous and independent individuals. We crave and we prize our freedom. And it further holds that whenever something very important to us, something that we think is a right, or something that we expect to have, is denied to us, then we can assert our autonomy and our freedom by doing or having that which was prohibited. And so it appeared to us that most college students felt that drinking is important to them. Most of them appear to hold that it is a right, and talk about the fact that they can join the military and that they are of the age of majority and so on. And certainly most of them expected to be able to drink. So when when the right to drink was rather suddenly denied to them, then all the conditions for a reactance motivation were in place. And by reactance motivation, I mean this negative reaction, this negative feeling toward the frustration. And, of course, as I indicated, that then tends to lead to doing that which has been prohibited. So within a few months after this nationwide legislation, the relationship that I just described of increased proportion of drinkers as students get older, that was completely reversed. And very suddenly, for the first time after all the decades that it's been studied, it was found that a larger percentage of underage students were suddenly drinking.
You know, I'm wondering, starting off with the premise that this nation is concerned about the alcohol and drug use among its kids, and that something has to be done. I mean, George Bush has been saying this, as we noted 2 decades ago, President Nixon was saying the same thing. I wonder if people aren't going to say, well, what do you expect? In the first generation of such a law, the first several years of such a law, people are going to react against it, are going to be a little like spoiled children and say, well, I want that. But over time, such a prohibitionist law will have an effect, and young people will take it as normal that they're not allowed to drink until 21, even though they can join the military, they can vote at age 18. Wait, do you have a response to that?
Yes.
We have to do something?
My first response is that you're very perceptive, and perhaps you should have been on our research team. That's exactly our expectation. That is to say, these conditions that that set up the circumstances for a negative reactance motivation will disappear as time goes on. That is to say, people will not see it as their right to be able to drink, or that they can expect to be able to drink legally. It will continue to be important for them, but so they will not have this saloon door slammed in their face, so to speak.
Mm-hmm.
And the other thing that was very unfortunate is that the legislation did not typically grandfather in drinkers, so that we have unknown hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of young people for whom drinking was legal and then suddenly became illegal. And you can easily imagine their negative reaction to that legislation. Now, there's a practical reason or an empirical reason why we also believe that this phenomenon will disappear over time. And that's based on the fact that about 5 years ago, Dr. Ings and I examined the drinking patterns and the drinking problems of college students in states with high versus low minimum drinking ages. And we restricted our study to those states which had maintained the same legislation unchanged for at least 10 years. And what we discovered very simply is that the age legislation is virtually irrelevant upon drinking patterns and drinking problems of college students. In other words, it doesn't really matter whether the legislation is high or low, students are going to drink about the same amount with the same problems in either case.
Which is why you say that legislation may not only be effective, but may actually encourage, in the short run, young people to drink?
In the short run, it appears to encourage. In the long run, I think it's simply irrelevant. Now, this doesn't mean to me that the drinking age itself really is totally irrelevant. I think that there are some negatives to a high minimum drinking age. If we're looking on college campuses, for example, and if drinking, say if 18, 19, 20-year-olds can drink, then they can seek help with drinking problems because it's a legal behavior.
Mm-hmm.
However, once the drinking age is raised, then people cannot seek out help. They can't go to residence life professionals. They can't go to the counseling center. They probably would be very reluctant to go to an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting on campus because that would suggest or actually admit that they're doing something that's illegal. So we drive the behavior underground where it can't be controlled. We could also be inadvertently encouraging them to use other drugs. A student in North Carolina recently said, well, I guess I can hide a little pot in my room a lot easier than a six-pack of beer.
Mm.
And in that particular college, mere possession of alcohol led to immediate suspension. So, you see, we can have some very negative effects. Another negative problem is that it tends to create some contempt for the law. Now, it's true, it seems to me, that the actual age that society selects is somewhat arbitrary. Why 21 rather than 18? Why 21 rather than 25? I think it's interesting that a few years ago, one of the houses of the Mississippi legislature actually passed a bill which would have established age 50 as the minimum drinking age in the state of Mississippi.
Age 50?
Yes, age 50. Now, the other house did not pass it, so it didn't become law. But you can say, well, why not 50? I think that 18 makes a lot of good sense for some of the reasons that you've already alluded to. At the age of 18, people can join the military. They are they're able to vote. That appears to be the age majority in virtually all states. So it would be consistent with certain other legal conditions, legal guidelines. I would point out that I think in the ideal world, there would be no minimum drinking age. Now, at this point, you may think I've truly lost all traces of sanity. But first point I would make is that until the mid-1930s, in other words, right after the repeal of Prohibition, there were virtually no laws at any level of government that restricted the right of young people to buy and consume alcoholic beverages. Before that period, of course, there was Prohibition, and no one could legally, or virtually no one, unless for medication, could buy alcohol. But before 1920, anyone of any age could buy and consume alcohol. Now, you might wonder, why would I say that in the ideal world, a person of the age of 6 or 7 should be able to consume alcohol? It really makes more sense than it might at first appear. We know that most Italians drink alcohol. We know that most Jews drink alcohol, for example. Both of those groups exhibit very, very low rates of either alcoholism or alcohol abuse. And one reason appears to be the fact that in both of these groups, young people, and by young people I'm talking about 6, 7, even younger, are able to drink under parental supervision. And very typically, they learn to drink at the dinner table, sipping wine with their meal. They see their parents and other adults using alcohol in moderation. And they don't equate alcoholism with adulthood, which is the key to one of our problems. Instead, they learn how to drink. And also, they see people drinking appropriately. At the same time, if they should see somebody drinking alcohol excessively, they will see that person suffer negative consequences. In both of these groups, the abuse of alcohol is very strongly frowned upon. So it seems to me that there's nothing inherently wrong with a young person drinking, so long as that person is drinking at least under parental or family guidance and in moderation. In the long run, it would appear that if they are going to drink at all, that's the best time, the best place for them to learn to drink. We know that problem drinkers tend to begin their drinking at a later age than do non-problem drinkers. So drinking early isn't the problem so much as it is the environment, the way in which alcohol is treated and perceived, and basically how they learn how to drink.
David Hansen, I'm willing to give you the ideal world and to also say, agree with you that, yes, it is reflected in certain cultures of our human world. But in 1989, and certainly since the 1960s, there's been a definite change in the pattern of our society regarding alcohol and in some ways regarding drugs. If we just look at television, commercial advertising and the amount of youth-oriented advertising that we see daily on our televisions, which says, drink alcohol, drink beer, drink wine, have more fun, be more adult, be handsome, be beautiful, be smarter. Those kinds of pressures certainly weren't on either ethnic or mainstream American society before the 20s, before the 30s, even before the 60s. We've undergone a radical change that we can at least see in 30-second commercials on our television. Does that change things in your mind?
Yes. Well, of course, I was speaking of the ideal world, and I'm not at all suggesting that we abolish minimum drinking ages. I would suggest, as I implied earlier, 18 as being a very logical, practical age. I think there are problems with broken homes, and we tend not to have these strong families that we had at one time. And you're quite right, society has changed so that it's not an ideal world. And apropos of what you're saying, is the fact that when we look at Italians, we look at first generation, second generation, third, and so on, we find that in those later generations, during which the Italian-American family becomes, shall we say, less Italian and more American, so to speak, more part of the American culture, that this immunity tends to erode. And so the less Italian folks are, the more American, the more likely they are to experience drinking problems.
So in some ways, if we are both aware of and prone to emphasize our differences within this culture, we may have more luck with teaching our children responsible behaviors?
Yes, if we had the Canadian approach, the Canadians don't look at themselves as a melting pot, but as a mosaic. And in a mosaic, it's easier for people to retain their cultural traditions. That would probably be very valuable.
Once again, we're talking with Dr. David Hansen, who's a professor of sociology at the State University of New York. His campus is located at Potsdam. His work, along with Dr. Ruth Engs of Indiana University, has been concentrated on drinking behaviors among college students, the results of which have been published in such periodicals as Newsweek, New York Times, aired on ABC News, and other major national media outlets. Dr. Hansen, let's turn to the second topic of our discussion. Actually, if we can draw the first one along with us, I think it'll be helpful for our listeners. But let's take a look at drug education programs. I'm particularly interested in the two or three things that datelines that I mentioned earlier in the program, that in 1970, Richard Nixon said, we have a drug problem, we have to address it in our schools from kindergarten to 12th grade. In 1973, the commission, National Commission on Marijuana and Drug Abuse, turned around and said, gee, I'm not sure, we're not sure this is, that we're doing the right thing here. And yet, drug programs continued. And then the last being in 1989, George Bush, our president currently, redeclared a war on drugs and said that a good deal had to be given over to drug education of our youth. Long question. Your response?
Well, I think in our society, one of the very natural responses that we typically have to a problem is education. That just seems to be almost a knee-jerk reaction to problems, and the assumption is that education will solve the problem. We say this with regard to human sexuality, venereal disease, and that sort of thing. And I think there were, of course, a number of problems in the early 70s. People rushed in to fix, so to speak, no pun intended, a problem, in this case a drug problem. And in essence, we created vast bureaucracies, educational bureaucracies, to deliver alcohol and drug education. And by the early 70s, people began realizing that this education was not necessarily having any particular positive effect. And what I did was, about 1980, I looked at all the research, published research, on the effectiveness of alcohol and drug education up to that point, and basically had to concur that the commission was quite right, that there was little evidence that alcohol and drug education was, in general, very effective. In fact, what I found was that it appears relatively easy to change people's knowledge or provide alcohol and drug knowledge. That was the easiest part. Much more difficult appears to be the problem of changing people's attitudes concerning alcohol or drugs. A major challenge, changing people's attitudes. And, of course, we're ultimately interested in behavior. And it appears that very few alcohol or drug education programs have been able to demonstrate positive impact upon behavior. In fact, some programs appear to be associated with an increase in alcohol or drug consumption, which is particularly frustrating and perplexing.
How does that happen?
Well, no one really knows. There are different ideas and explanations. For example, at a very young age, if we provide alcohol and drug education, we might cause these young people to begin thinking of themselves as potential users when before they hadn't.
Hmm.
It might be in a long-term program simply a false finding in the sense that maybe they would have increased anyways along with their maturity. So I'm not inclined to say that alcohol and drug education is undesirable, but there is just virtually no evidence that it is of any value at all.
That one thought that you raised, which is that there is some concern or some signs in studies that young people will actually begin to use where they might otherwise remain abstinent, is a major concern of people who fight, for example, sex education in the schools. They say it will focus children's minds on sexuality at far too early an age and put the tools of education into their hands to use.
Well, it's interesting you should mention the sex education because I did review the literature on that subject a couple of years ago. And as you know, there are a group of people who say that sex education is undesirable because it will increase sexuality on the part of young people. And then there are the folks on the other side who argue that that sex education could lower the incidence of premarital pregnancies and venereal disease.
Right.
Well, it turns out that both sides are wrong. That there just isn't any evidence that sex education increases or stimulates sexual activity on the part of young people. On the other hand, it's very disappointing in that there just isn't any good evidence that sex education leads people to either avoid sexual behavior or to take precautions to avoid either venereal disease or premarital pregnancy. Again, it just doesn't seem to have any real impact at all.
You know, I said at the onset of this program that what you have to say might be a bit disturbing. It is a bit disturbing. If we're pumping millions of dollars into, and a great deal of national concern, into attempting to educate our children, whether it is about sexual matters or whether it is about drug and alcohol, and here is a researcher sitting on my show saying, well, actually, we think it does little or no good. I mean, I hate to phrase the question this way, but what's a nation to do?
Okay. And when you think about it in the larger perspective, it's even worse. Because I've already implied that legislation just is not going to be effective at all in having any positive impact. Well, if legislation doesn't work, and if education doesn't work, then it certainly seems to be a depressing situation. Let me expand the idea that education doesn't work. There have been studies going back for decades about the effectiveness of education in general. That is to say, for example, the impact of college education. Well, sort of poorly conducted studies usually will show that that college has a great impact on people's earning ability and so on. But a carefully controlled study that looks at, well, that controls for intelligence and socioeconomic background and so on, in other words, looks at very similar people, some of whom go to college, some of whom don't, usually finds that the impact of college education is minimal. Now we're talking about 4 intense years of education not having much impact. So we can certainly see that short-run alcohol and drug education programs or short-run sex education programs don't really have a chance to be successful at all.
David Hansen, what do you think about that? I mean, after all, you are a professor of sociology at a fairly major university in this country.
Well, it's discouraging. That's one reason, incidentally, why there is currently a nationwide movement for assessment, both assessment of education, both at the secondary and higher education levels. So colleges and high schools are increasingly being asked to demonstrate that students develop or improve in certain important ways as they go through the curriculum. And I think this is a healthy sign. What we've done in the past, for political and other reasons, is throw education at people, the alcohol and drug education, the sex education. And we say, okay, if we give them the sex education at school, we don't have to talk with our children at home about sex. You see, it's convenient, it's easy, it makes us feel good. And if we have alcohol and drug education, then that will solve the problem, and we don't have to worry about it. So the education makes us feel good, makes us feel as if we're doing something, but we haven't asked ourselves, what are the consequences? We forgot to ask the really important question.
Which is,
unfortunately, there are bureaucracies that have developed to deliver alcohol and drug education in particular, and they're very resistant to change. And even if we find that these programs aren't working, which is typically what we find, the programs continue essentially unaltered.
But as you say, certainly in Fairbanks, our local schools are beginning to strain, it seems a bit, at their added responsibilities. They are required to educate our youth, but at least up to the age of 16. But in addition to that, there is sex education, AIDS and other sexually transmitted disease education, drug education, alcohol education, I don't know what all else. Parenting in some cases is taught in schools, nutrition, all sorts of lifestyle choices, problems, issues are forced on the schools to raise with their students.
Yes, to some degree we're asking the schools to take over the responsibilities of the families. I'm not saying that the families were ever particularly successful in doing these things, but in the past these were seen as the prerogative of the family, mm-hmm. and it was a family responsibility to deal with these things.
As a researcher, once again, what do you think about that? That we've given up certain responsibilities to the schools, which we may not have been doing very well in the first place?
Well, we shifted responsibility. I don't think we've improved effectiveness, of course.
So should we shift back?
Well, the problem is that the family, the traditional family that we see on Father Knows Best, reruns at least, doesn't exist as a majority family form anymore. The traditional, what I will call the truly traditional family, the family of the 50s, what we thought was the family of the 50s, is truly a minority family these days. In large numbers of one-parent families and of other different family forms, and so to a large degree, we're expecting a myth to educate young people. We're expecting a family that doesn't exist to educate young people.
Let's look at this question from another direction, if we might. For one thing, it's rather depressing to take a look at our educational efforts and say, well, they're essentially no good. And perhaps that's reason enough.
Well, I suppose people, if we were sarcastic, we could say, well, at least they aren't doing much harm. But that is not much of a, that doesn't make us feel very good when we realize the time and effort and the money and other resources that goes into this.
My question to you is, you said that you found that drug and alcohol education programs are pretty good at affecting knowledge, that is to say they increase knowledge, but relatively lousy at affecting attitude or behavioral change. Where in our society is there evidence of successful influencers of attitude? Are there?
Yes. Now, the picture that I've sketched for you, all in somber black tones, obviously, this morning, is that legislative approaches don't work, the formal educational approaches don't work, and that seems rather dismal and bleak. There is one ray of hope, it seems to me, and that is, as adults, as parents, we have much more influence over our children than we ordinarily realize. When I talked about the Italians and the Jews, for example, one of the things we know is that those parents really did have and do have tremendous influence. We tend to be aware of the differences between ourselves and our parents or ourselves and our children. And that obscures the fact that for the most part, we are very, very similar to our parents. We don't really realize how similar to our parents we are. And we don't realize how similar our young people are to us. So the bottom line, it seems to me, is that as parents, if we drink, and if we believe that drinking is acceptable for adults, then we should, first off, use alcohol in a responsible manner ourselves. And then secondly, we would provide alcohol in a controlled environment in the home to our offspring. Now, this doesn't mean that when our children go off to college or join the military, that they're going to drink with the moderation always that we've demonstrated. I have every reason to believe, and all the evidence suggests, that they will in fact experiment. Remember I talked about that freshman year. Mm-hmm. They're going to go off and they're going to experiment, often in ways that we don't like. But in the long run, there's every reason to believe that they will tend to emulate, to follow our behavior. And I would stress our behavior, not what we tell them, but what we did. It's very important that our behavior be what we would like our children's behavior to be. And of course, what we say should also reinforce that. But it's really the behavior that we model rather than what we say that's important.
And in the same way, and I'm going back to what you said about the mythical family here, in the same way, another thing we have to do is to take a look at the families as we have them, whether they are single parent, nuclear, extended, of whatever sort, and acknowledge that to be the true and real family in this country, however it comes. That is to say, to give more credibility to that family unit. It seemed to me a minute ago that when you said the family doesn't exist, it was an opportunity for us to stop and take a look that we haven't given the family that does exist a great deal of credibility. We've said, well, that's a broken home.
Yes. And young people are going to follow the behavior of their parents or other caregivers. I hate that word, significant others, but, you know, the parents or whoever those folks might be. And unfortunately, this will be so if that behavior is negative. You know, we have a lot of evidence that child abusers are likely to have been abused themselves. We know that children of alcoholics run a very high possibility, if not probability, of being alcoholics themselves. So when the behavior, even when the behavior is negative, and when we see this in our parents and we say we don't want to be like that, we don't want to do that, that's the behavior that's been modeled. That's what we've learned. In a pinch, that's what we fall back on. And so this is, of course, creates difficult public policy implications, but at the individual level, the message is very clear that we have to do what we want our offspring to be. And that's the best as parents that we can do. And this is true with religion, it's true with morality and honesty and political and social beliefs and so on. We have to, you know, to profess and to practice those things that we want our offspring to practice and profess when they become adults.
And in many ways, this comes down to the level of individual responsibility. You're saying indirectly that the nation and the state can't do a great deal about what does not already happen in a home in the United States.
I think that's right. Now, this doesn't mean that there aren't some public policy implications. We know that with regard to smoking, that the government has been able to remove the advertising of tobacco from television, for example. It might be prudent for us as a society to consider doing that with regard to alcohol as well. I'm not talking about prohibiting alcohol any more than I'd advocate prohibiting tobacco. That would create all sorts of problems, needless to say, just as prohibition did in this country. But so much of the alcohol ads and advertising is directed toward young people. In many ways, it sends out the wrong signals about the role of alcohol in our lives, the proper place of alcohol in our lives. And while I might say that I would gladly give up drinking, and I would, because I don't smoke, but I'd be happy if there were no tobacco on the face of the earth. I would be equally happy if there were no alcohol on the face of earth. But unfortunately, both of those things do exist, and they've been part of our society for a long time, and so we can't abolish them. We have to learn how best to motivate individuals to use these things in moderation if they choose to use them.
Are there any nations doing a more effective job than ours?
Pardon me?
Are there any nations doing a more effective job than ours?
Yes. Italy, for example, does a very good job. Many societies, of course, do a poorer job than we do. And all societies seem to do this with less legislation than we do. Unfortunately, the stereotype of Irish alcoholic does have an unfortunately large grain of truth to it. And the French are not particularly successful with handling alcohol either. And it's interesting that while young people can drink in France, for example, and they see other people using alcohol, the problem in France is that alcohol, the abuse of alcohol is not frowned upon. And alcohol is pushed, should we say. People are encouraged to drink it to excess. And this is clearly the case, unfortunately, in Ireland. And at least with a traditional Irish person, you could offend such a person if you refused to drink. And so you're really, in essence, forced to drink, and many of the Irish customs encourage people, almost force people to drink too much. And simultaneously, drunkenness and alcoholism and alcohol abuse are, for the most part, not frowned upon. The Irish tend to be accepting of alcohol abuse, except in the most extreme cases, typically cases in which people would lose tenure to their land, that sort of thing. And simultaneously, much in Irish literature and Irish culture seems to praise and look very favorably upon the excessive use of alcohol.
In our own country, do you see our attitudes changing to a more, to a less excessive environment for, or attitude towards drinking?
I'm sorry, I didn't understand the question.
I kind of expressed it poorly there. In our country, do you see us becoming less excessive in our relationship to alcohol? Are our own attitudes changing in this country?
They probably are changing less than we realize. And I say that because Dr. Ings and I have been looking at responses to questions dealing with attitudes toward alcohol on our surveys since 1970. And it's really amazing the extent to which attitudes seem to be rather consistent over time, at least among college students. And if we were having dramatic changes, we might very well expect to see those changes among collegians, perhaps first. So, in response, I would have to say that I don't really have good evidence that attitudes are in general changing dramatically. I think impressionistically it seems to me that we are tending to look upon or become more aware of some of the problems of excessive drinking.
Mm-hmm.
And it's gratifying to see young people in particular taking extensive advantage of assigned driver programs and that sort of thing, and that has become extremely popular in many high schools and in many colleges. Of course, what's going to happen to those programs is kind of hard to say. It's at the high school level. They can still continue to exist at the college level where we have people who can legally drink. It does seem to me that we have an increased concern with health in this country, tied in with the idea that excessive use of alcohol is not a helpful or a healthy thing to do.
So in some ways, and this is a final question because we're at the end of our hour, but in some ways our alarm at excessive drinking, our alarm at illegal drug use, our alarm at excessive use of prescription drugs, included in that, is a healthy thing at this point for our country, even if we may not be making some of the right moves in terms of education or in terms of legislation.
Yes, because if we're not concerned, then clearly we're not going to make efforts to do anything about the problem.
Dr. David Hansen, I want to thank you for joining us for this hour. Again, Dr. Hansen is professor of sociology at the State University of New York at Potsdam. He is a researcher, along with his colleague Ruth C. Engs of Indiana University, into the areas of collegiate drinking patterns, and in addition to that, the area of drug education and its value for our country. David Hansen, thanks for sharing an hour.
Thank you. I've enjoyed it.
All right. Best to you. Thank you for joining us on KUAC-FM today. I'm Susan McGinnis. We'll talk to you again next week.